we would have really...
Morning, everyone. We're going to get started. Welcome to this cool Monday morning.
Are the mics on?
Looks like we're good to go. Labor, workplace, and regulated industries. I've been cautioned not to run a stuffy Senate meeting, so I'll try not to do that. Keep things moving along here. First order of business is approval of the minutes. Representative Simonson moves approval of the minutes for March 20th, 2013 meeting. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. The minutes are approved. Let's move on to the Nelson bill, House File 1765. Representative Nelson moves that House File 1765 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration with a recommended re-referral to the Committee on GovOps.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just before the meeting started, I told you I had to make a correction, and I'm being told now that I don't have to make that correction, so the bill is the way it needs to be. On line 1.12, I was told that number was wrong, and I've been informed that it is right, so I was wrong about having to correct it. Anyway, the purpose of this bill, labor peace agreements, is nothing new in the state of Minnesota. We've required these on an individual basis multiple times in the past on projects that the state of Minnesota has put money in through TIF dollars or other subsidies. And what basically it is, it's a lot like a project labor agreement that I, as a construction worker, and we here are quite familiar with. But this is for on the back end. After the project is done, it allows the hospitality unions or the other unions that follow behind to be able to have labor peace and not have to fight to get in and talk to the workers. The purpose for this is basically to protect the state's rights, our proprietary rights that we have in these projects. We spend money or we give a subsidy to get these buildings built, and then a labor strike or a labor strife can cause issues about them getting up and running and becoming profitable, being a payoff, and pay off the bills that we have done there. So that is why this bill is for us. It's basically to allow the union that goes in afterwards, the hospitality union, to be able to go in and talk to the workers. And it doesn't bind the businesses, it doesn't bind the state of Minnesota as much as it binds the hotel workers to be able to not do the things that they do, boycotts, picketing, and outside the buildings, causing a disruption. It stops them from doing that. The management of the company that's building the hotel agrees to allow them to talk to the workers, and that's the only thing they're agreeing to. But it doesn't, that they don't have to agree to form a union, they don't have to agree to sign a contract, they don't have to do any of that, but it prevents the hospitality union from causing problems. And that's what the bill's about. And I'll take questions. There should be a handout that was handed out, in the pack. I see everyone's got that.
Members, questions, Representative Benson?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we have any testifiers today outside of the author? Anybody from the chamber? Nobody signed up?
To my knowledge, Representative, nobody has signed up.
Okay. I guess I have a number of questions.
Representative Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So all due respect, it's rare that Representative Nelson would bring us a bill that would be worrying about the developer in this case. Son of a gun.
Actually, it's what about the state? This is protecting the state's interest,
okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Well, I have a number of questions.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, that are actually around that. So concerns about whether or not this would indeed increase costs to the state government regarding this bill in terms of, Mr. Chairman, and to our testifier, Representative Nelson, might there be a chance that you'll have fewer people that would be interested in bidding on these projects because of the issue of having to sign one of these? I've got a number of questions as they regard to, is this another door into unionizing, organizing, and things of that nature? And if they take state dollars, don't they already have to be covered by a labor agreement and so on and so forth? So let me start with, This won't have any impact at all on the cost of the state doing business in terms of funds. I'm thinking of the Viking Stadium, first of all.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the upfront building costs, cost of the Viking Stadium, and by the way, the Vikings have signed a labor peace agreement with the hospitality unions afterwards, but it doesn't affect the building part of it. This is the hospitality union. These are the servers, the waiters, and the hotel would be the people that the people that clean the beds, clean the rooms, those type of people that are represented by the hospitality union. Afterwards, they would come in, and if they don't, you know, they've done a lot of different things in the past that can disrupt the activity of the project getting open on time. And that what they're agreeing by getting this signed is they're agreeing that we will have a cross the table, honest discussion with people because we're going to be able to do that. And not have to worry about doing these pressure tactics to try and get that opportunity. But it does not affect the building of the building.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. So with that out of the way, except for the fact that possibly somebody could file an injunction and stop it, there's really still no guarantee that even if they come up with the Peace in the Valley agreement, that they still couldn't picket those buildings. It only takes one or two days of doing that, and there's some disruption or ill will and so on. So this is a lockdown guarantee that if there's a Peace in the Valley, there's never going to be any picketing?
Representative Nelson?
With this agrees with the signing of the labor peace agreement, the management of the company that's going to operate the facility afterwards agrees that they're going to allow the workers to come in and talk, and the union gives up their right to picket, similar to a project labor agreement where the building trades agree by signing a project labor agreement. We agree that if there's any issues that we have to resolve, we'll resolve them off-site, but we won't picket the job, and we will not do any slowdowns or labor or work disruptions on the job, but we'll discuss those off-site and solve those, and the work will go on.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, but what I hear from that, and just your testifying here, that they're going to agree to talk, but if they don't come up with some kind of written agreement in the end that they're going to unionize the people, the personnel that are going to be working in that facility, they could still picket.
Representative Nelson?
Representative Benson, Mr. Chair, no, they agreed not to picket. That's what they're agreeing. The unions are saying if we get a labor peace agreement, we won't picket. That's part of the labor peace agreement. That's what they're giving up.
Representative Benson?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, so they don't sign. So the goal of the union is to have unionized workers working in the facility, the SEIU, for example. All right. They don't come to an agreement that the people that are working on site are going to be card-carrying SEIU members. What's the outcome here?
Well, Representative Nelson,
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, the outcome here is they would continue to talk. The management agrees not to do some of the more harsh non-union tactics that they have there, but they're giving up their right to do that. They're allowing the people to come in, the union workers to come, the union representatives to come in and talk to the employees, and it's up to the employees to decide whether they want to vote to have a union. And then once they vote to, if they vote to have a union, then they go through the normal negotiating process. It just tries to set up some peace there so we're not having the disruptions out on the street, disruptions of the projects that could take place currently that is the right of the union to do. They're giving up that right in agreement to have this labor peace and to be able to talk to the workers.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just going to finish with this, is that I'm really surprised that there aren't people from the industry and development and so on that aren't at the table and testifying today. I know these are, they get publicized and so on. This has got to make a trip to GovOps, okay. And then to rules, because it's missed deadlines.
Rules first, then GovOps.
Okay. My only hope is that we have some additional people with to be able to testify on whether or not they feel like this is something that's needed, rather than just taking one view. So I'll end it with that, and thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You're welcome. Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess my concern in listening to a lot of these union bills throughout is you're saying, okay, we won't picket the corporation, but we get access to the employees. and we're going to try to persuade them to join the union. Is that correct? Am I understanding that correct?
Representative Nelson?
Representative, Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, yeah, that's correct. That's okay. In a nutshell. They agree that we're going to give up our right to strike, but you're going to allow us to be able to have access to the employees, and that's basically what they're trading. There's a quid pro quo. They're trading one thing for the other.
Mr. Chair,
Kiefer?
I guess my concern is, I think about the employees. We had this conversation already with some of the housekeepers and what they pay in union fees and versus what they're going to get an increase in minimum wage. And I'm afraid that the workers lose some of the protection from their employer. Like, maybe they love their employer and they really want that job, and they don't want to be harassed or arm-twisted or constantly sent propaganda to join a union. Maybe they don't want to. Is there a time when your union finally lets up and says, okay, we won't bother these folks anymore? Like the daycare stuff. We've gotten tons of emails that they don't want to be unionized, but we're still going to push forward a bill to force them to take a vote with only a 10% threshold. So I'm just wondering, when do you let up on the employee if they're not interested?
Representative Nelson?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, current law, this would be National Labor Relations Act law. Current law says they get to a vote. If they get enough people to say, yes, I want to do this, they get to a vote and they lose the vote, they can't talk to them for a year. I mean, they can't talk to them for a year, and they got to start all over again later on. So what this basically does is, as these projects are being built and we're investing dollars, we're trying to protect the state of Minnesota's investment in these projects to make sure that they get up and running, they become profitable, so that we don't build a hotel that becomes a white elephant and gets closed, like there's one in my district that's gotten closed because of improper management and failure, that allows these projects that we're not stuck as the state of Minnesota with a property we've invested in and having a white elephant.
Representative Uecklin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, good morning.
Good morning.
These covered workers who are going to be covered under this bill, it's a wide net, isn't it? I mean, under the North American Industry Classification System, that's what's going to apply here, is that correct?
Representative Nelson?
Representative Uglum and Mr. Chair, yes. It's not really a wide net. It's the people that work in the hospitality industry. It's the servers. It's the people that clean the rooms. It's those people in that hospitality industry. And I could probably more of them than I'm not thinking about, the janitors that clean the building, those type of things.
Representative Uglum?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, under that classification, that includes business and financial operations, computer and mathematical people, architecture, engineering, legal, education, training, library, arts, design, entertainment, sports, media, health care, preparation and serving, building and grounds cleaning, maintenance, personal care services, sales, office and administrative support, farming, fishing, forestry, construction, extraction, installation and maintenance and repair, production and transportation and material moving according to that particular code. So are all these people going to be covered under this bill?
Representative Nelson?
If they're in that section of code, yes.
That seems to me to be a pretty wide net. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Benson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One last question. I'm not surprised, I guess, but I'd like to get it from you. This comes on the heels of the Destination Medical Center, where there's going to be a potential bill that will get signed, and everybody knows that in terms of making that a destination, ultimately they're going to need to expand not only the medical facilities, which I think the clinic's ready to invest to double that size, but there'll be a substantial investment in hotels and motels and the like. I think Rochester, as far as a market, is the second largest outside, and actually rivals both, if you take them separately, Minneapolis and St. Paul. Since there's going to be, quote, public investment in this a new district down there, wouldn't this apply to any of the hotels and motels that would be built within that district in Rochester, Minnesota?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, if they take public subsidies, yes, they would be included.
Okay, so, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Benson.
So, was this somewhat designed and somewhat of an anticipation, potentially, of that being signed? Because I guess, as we know, ultimately, that's going to be easily called public money, although that money's going into infrastructure. It's infrastructure, not the individual hotels or motels that will be. But since it is, in effect, a TIF area, couldn't that not be construed as taking public money for infrastructure as an investment to build that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Benson, I would think, depending on what it is, but yes, it could be construed as that. But my understanding is this did not come out of the Destination Medical Center, the DMC. I had to remember what the exact word term was, but it didn't come out of that. This came out of actually something in the metro area here. And in the metro area, St. Paul has done this project by project, and the city of Minneapolis actually has this as an ordinance.
Thank you.
Representative Kiefer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We got a handout. I don't know who handed it.
That's my handout.
Oh, thank you. Okay, so there's very reputable hotels that you said have already signed these agreements. So something you said to me earlier is one of the hotels closed. Is that one of these hotels, or could you explain?
Representative Kiefer, Mr. Chair, no. There's a hotel in my district that has gotten closed. The city actually closed it down because of poor management practices.
Representative Kiefer?
Would the union have solved that problem? Can you be a little more specific? Which one was it? What closed? Why did it close? And how would the union have prevented that from happening?
Mr. Chair, Representative Kiefer, that actually was not a union hotel, and I just raise that as an interest, as that right now is sitting there as a property that's a white elephant in the city of Brooklyn Park that Brooklyn Park has been trying to deal with. It was sold to the city of Brooklyn Park and was given TIF dollars by the city of Brooklyn Park as being able to help our finances in the city and do wonderful things for the city of Brooklyn Park. And right now, it's sitting closed, and that's so it's sitting there as we put TIF dollars into that, and now we're sitting there with it not generating any money, and basically being a drag on the city's resources.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry to hear that. One more reason we should start to allow more private investment rather than getting into these projects. But anyway, one last question: can the union organize through card check?
Ben Nelson.
Under the labor peace agreement?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Kiefer, what this basically is a little bit like card check, but that's the way unions organize. They get authorizations cards signed by the employees that wish to join a union. Once they get enough authorization cards signed to trigger an election, they go to an election. And once they have the election, if they get over 50% of the people that work there to vote yes, then that starts the process of trying to negotiate a contract or a first contract with the entity that they're negotiating with. That's the normal procedure for getting to an election. So there is cards signed, and a lot of the rhetoric around card check is blowing that up, but whether they get cards signed and to get authorization so that they have interest. And that's part of the process, the normal process, through the National Labor Relations Board to get to an election.
Representative Yukon?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Nelson, the National Sports Center is in the bonding bill for a big expansion this year. I think we both know that. And on something like this, then, would it be an opportunity for union organizations to go in and talk to, for instance, some of the sports people that work there? In other words, unionizing this sport venue and the ice arenas and things like that under this North American industry classification system, I'm thinking that could happen.
Representative
Benson,
and Mr. Chair, I believe that's a public entity, and that's run as a public entity. It's not run as a private entity, and they would fall under Public Employee Labor Relations Act and would have to go through the PELRA process.
Okay. Very good. Seeing no further questions, the Chair renews his motion that House File 1767.
Roll call this vote, Mr. Chair.
Roll call being requested.
that
Mr.
House
Chair,
House
was it my motion to pass it?
Yes. Representative Nelson renews his motion that 1765 be recommended to pass and re-refer to the Committee on Rules and Legislative Administration with the recommended re-referral to Committee on Government Ops. A roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll.
Johnson?
Yes.
Benson?
No.
Fisher?
Yes.
Hoppe? Kiefer?
No.
Lane? Mason? Metza?
Yes.
Nelson?
Yes.
O'Driscoll? O'Neill?
No.
Savick? Simonson?
Yes.
Sundin?
Yes.
Uglum?
No.
The vote being 6-4, the motion passes and the bill moves on to Rules Committee. Thank you, Representative Nelson, and thank you, members from the Transportation Finance Committee, for coming over and visiting with us. Okay. Members, we're going to move on next to House File 985, and I'm going to, it's my bill, but I'm going to stay in my chair here and ask that the testifiers and so forth that testify from up front there. You'll notice those in the audience that a few people are leaving. There's committees going on at this time that they need to attend, so that's what is occurring, as you probably figured out. What I will do, however, is send a link of the testimony today to the members of the committee so they have a chance to listen to what was said today. Look forward to whatever testimony is provided so we can help inform and educate our committee on this very important topic. So with that, members, I'm going to move House File 985 before us. And I think we'll start off with Bob Eliff giving us a rundown on what it is we're looking at here. So, Mr. Eliff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I take to heart your words about informing and educating. I must admit, when you asked me last week to summarize this bill, I was more than a little daunted. It's not very often that a bill comes before a committee which pretty much thoroughly rewrites a chapter of statute, in this case Chapter 237, which regulates telephones and telecommunication. Members will note that the title of Article 1 on page 1 is Statute Modernization, and I guess in the largest sense that's what's going on here. But this is an effort that has been going on for at least 30 years in telecommunications. It's been 30 years since, in 1982, AT&T agreed to divest itself of the Bell operating companies that provided local exchange service, which kind of started us towards, I guess, what in the largest sense we can call a deregulation of telecommunications. And in 1996, Congress passed the Telecommunications Act, which furthered that along. So there were, those were instances where legislation was modernizing essentially what had been caused by advances in technology, and that's what's driving it. I think we're all familiar with the advances in telecommunications that have made today's telephone system very different from the one most of us grew up with. And to a certain extent, I think government regulators are always trying to catch up with the technology and also the economics that the technology kind of imposes in an area. This is an informational hearing, and I expect that we'll be holding more informational hearings on this during the interim and next session. Which I think is helpful, because the other thing I was thinking is I think this is the first telecommunications bill, or maybe the second, to come before this committee. And what we're telling them is, well, we have to change everything that's operated up until now, which I certainly could understand the discomfort of members in approaching something like that. I think what I might do is kind of go through the bill quickly, section by section, just to give, I think what it'll do is give people a flavor of what we're dealing with here, and probably a sense of how complicated this is, which I think is a positive thing to do. There are 25 sections in the bill, and if you've taken a look, there are even more sections that are repealed from current statutes. I believe about 50 sections are repealed. So we'll just take a quick run through from the bill. My expectation is that the testifiers will present kind of an overview of the entire bill, which is probably where we want to be right now. But I think at least members will have a sense for some of the nitty-gritty that's actually in the bill. Sections 1 to 7 are definitions, and maybe one of the most important of which is a definition of what is called basic services, which basically means one unbundled single line, single telephone line with unlimited usage. I guess what we used to call plain old telephone service, both from a residential and a business point of view. Section 8 of the bill is a very important section. It provides that effective July 1st, 2019, the regulatory duties of the Department of Commerce are transferred to the Public Utilities Commission. The Department of Commerce has historically participated in proceedings at the Public Utilities Commission regarding the regulation of telecommunications services. And this section of the bill provides that in 2019 those duties will be transferred to the commission itself. Sections 2 and 3 allow telephone companies to provide reduced rates to schools, libraries, and state government agencies. Section 11 of the bill requires that carriers offering interstate access services or local exchange carrier providing basic services continue to file tariffs for those services with the commission, but they can also enter into an individual contract with customers to provide either retail or wholesale services. Sections 12 through 16 refer to the Public Utilities Commission's powers with respect to investigation of telecommunications services.
Mr. Elip, just briefly, could you explain to the, if you think you can, what a tariff is?
Oh.
That might not be immediately clear.
Certainly, Mr. Chair. In essence, a tariff is a charge. Most often, it's simply a price for a specific service, although it can also have other conditions besides price in terms of term or different kinds of services, but I think that helps a little bit. So Section 12 allows the Commission to investigate whenever it believes that a basic or wholesale telecommunications service is inadequate. Investigations can also be begun when 5% or 100 customers, whichever is fewer, of a telephone company subscribers petition to the Commission for such an investigation. Section 14 allows the Commission to hold a contested case hearing after an investigation regarding the reasonableness of a company's rates for basic service. Section 15 says that if the Commission finds that a basic or wholesale service is unavailable or unreasonable or discriminatory, the Commission shall issue an order making it a just and reasonable. Section 16 prohibits discrimination with the offering of any basic or wholesale service. Section 17 requires the Commission to maintain confidentiality of all proprietary information. Section 18 allows a local exchange carrier who feels they have not been fully compensated by another exchange carrier for use of its services to discontinue accepting traffic from that carrier after notifying the Commission, and the Commission may determine that if continued service is in the public interest, it can require that and also fix the amount of compensation and the terms. Section 19 prohibits a telephone company from violating a statutory restriction against what we call slamming, which is changing a user's local exchange carrier without the user's permission. Section 20 describes how the department and the commission shall assess regulatory costs on companies. And interestingly, in July 2019, it specifies that the fee assessment cap that's allowed under this will be reduced by 75%, indicating a lower amount of regulation after 2019. Sections 21 specifies how advanced service providers will calculates surcharges for the Telecommunication Access Minnesota program, which provides equipment to hard-of-hearing Minnesotans, and also for the Telephone Assistance Plan, which provides financial assistance for low-income individuals. Section 22 requires the Commission to set the per-number fee necessary to fund those services. Section 23 prohibits a company from what is called cramming, which is including third-party charges on a customer's bill, which the user did not explicitly authorize. Section 24 requires companies to receive a certificate of authority from the Commission prior to offering basic or wholesale services in this state. What's called advanced service providers must only register with the Commission 60 days after beginning operations here. And Section 25 refers to alternative regulation plans, which become terminated on the effective date of this act. And I should give a little bit of background on that. Alternative form of regulation plans are called AFORs, A-F-O-R, which was a change that was adopted some years ago, which essentially gave created a regulatory environment with, I'd say, greater flexibility than is available under the traditional rate of return regulation that the Commission did. It separated telecommunication services into those that were price regulated, those that were called flexibly priced, and those that were non-price regulated to give companies a lot more leeway in changing prices. This bill specifies that on the date, the effective date of the act, those alternative regulation plans are terminated. Mr. Chair, that completes the sections of the bill. As I mentioned, there are many sections of existing statutes that are repealed as a result of this bill, but those are the basics.
Thank you. Thank you for that overview. Members, this is, as you can tell, a very complex and complicated bill, and it's one that we plan on working on over the interim, and that we'll be taking up again in 2014, more than likely in some form. So that's what's happening, and feel free to ask questions. What we're going to do is move forward with some testimony, and I'm hoping that the testifiers can largely, because we're going to forget, I think, the details of some of this information today, but speak in terms of a broader overview. And if you want to provide some details, that's fine too. But just to understand why this change is necessary, a little bit maybe about the history and why we're doing this in the first place, so members can have some clarity on the importance or the necessity for this kind of legislation. With that, I see we have Scott Bowler here. Scott? Mr. Bowler, welcome, and come on up to the testifier's table. And I know you do a good job of overview information. If you want to speak to the committee, I'd appreciate it.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for letting me speak this morning. My name is Scott Bowler, and I'm with Frontier Communications. Frontier is incumbent local exchange carrier. That's a term you're going to hear, incumbent local exchange carrier, traditional telephone company. We serve approximately 190,000 access lines across the state of Minnesota, and we support this bill 985. Just by way of background, there are approximately 7.25 million telephone access lines of one sort or another in Minnesota. About 4 million, well, 4.75 million of those are wireless, and that number is growing. About 1 million of those lines are provided by cable companies, competitive local exchange carriers, or voice over IP providers like Vonage. That number is growing. About 1.5 million of those lines are provided by ILEX, traditional phone companies like Frontier. That number is shrinking year over year. Yet, under Minnesota's current telecom regulatory format, the Public Utilities Commission regulates the retail services of only the ILEX, who now account for only about 1/5 of the lines in the state and a dwindling market share. While the other players in the market, with 4/5 of the lines and rising, have essentially no regulatory obligations on their retail services. current regulatory framework for the commission was designed to address a monopoly environment for retail telecommunications services where only the ILX provided local service. That situation is long gone. Today, there is a robust competitive marketplace where customers have choices among various providers for their telecommunications needs. The state law needs to reflect the current situation of vigorous competition and multiple provider options for customers by doing away with the regulatory rules and requirements that were developed to address a monopoly environment of decades ago and that apply only today to a small fraction of the providers. The bill language recognizes the competitive market in place for retail services, and that commission regulation of those services is no longer necessary or appropriate. While the bill might be characterized as a deregulatory bill, that term's not really accurate. As I noted before, 80% of retail telecommunications market in this state is already deregulated in effect, being provided by wireless carriers or CLECs. Only the ILECs remain subject to retail regulation by the commission. The bill simply attempts to put the ILECs in a more equitable footing with respect to their retail services. However, the bill takes a conservative approach to this change. The commission retains authority over basic local service, as was mentioned, so concerns about ensuring a basic level of connectivity are addressed. The commission will also be able to respond to complaints about price or availability of basic service, and after an investigation, order appropriate changes. Other competitive carriers obtain services from ILX on a wholesale basis, and they use those services to provide retail services to their own customers. These wholesale services are generally purchased pursuant to what are called interconnection agreements. The bill retains the Commission's authority over interconnection agreements and the wholesale arrangements between the various providers that have enabled the current robust competition. So there's no threat of backsliding in that respect. Much of the Commission's work in this area is done pursuant to direction from the Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, and the Commission retains the authority necessary to carry out those FCC-delegated responsibilities. The current Lifeline programs provide for affordable service for low-income households, and this is not impacted by the bill, so there is no threat to this affordable service, to this segment of the market either. Many other states, like Wisconsin, Iowa, Indiana, Michigan, etc., have recently taken similar steps, and there have not been any negative consequences to customers. It's time for Minnesota law to reflect the current realities of the telecommunications marketplace here in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Bullard, for your testimony. Members, any questions to testify? There are no dumb questions, because this is a very complicated field, and if you have any questions at all, feel free to ask them. Anything? Nothing? Referendum Keeper?
Just clarification, because you're right, I don't know too much about, but I'm just wondering, the Commerce Department's going to give up any kind of regulatory oversight. Is that correct? And is the Commerce Department in favor of this as well?
Good question, and they're going to testify as well, but okay. Mr. Bowler, did you want to say anything to this?
Yes, that function from the Department of Commerce will be transferred to the commission. And I guess by way of background, there's two agencies that are dealing with regulatory issues here in Minnesota, which is kind of unusual. Most states have streamlining.
Representative Kiefer, follow up?
Well, I guess then also with the taxing authority, the tariffs, whatever you want to call it, what's the oversight there? Where does the money go right now that's collected with our fees that we see on our phone bills? And then making sure that there's still some transparency and accountability there.
Mr. Bowler, any comments?
Yes. This doesn't really affect, and perhaps what you're talking about is like the universal service fees or 911, TAP, TAM fees. This wouldn't affect that process, those funding arrangements would remain in place, so you'll still see those charges on your bill, I guess.
Oh, Mr. Chair, I know we'd still see them. I just want to make sure that you know, we don't give all this authority to one group and then there's no accountability or transparency, or all of a sudden it doubles and we don't know why as consumers. And maybe that's where the department would speak to that.
Very good. Well, thank you for your testimony. Let's go to Brent Christensen. I know you wanted to say a few words. Get a little feedback somewhere and try to figure it out. Well, welcome, Mr. Christensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee.
Identify yourself for the record and go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Brent Christensen, and I am with the Minnesota Telecom Alliance, and we're a trade association that represents over 70 landline telephone companies in the state, predominantly all the carriers except for Frontier and Windstream. And, you know, today consumers have a choice. Cell phones, voice over internet, services, VoIP, like Vonage and Magic Jack. Their traditional landline service or a combination of the above. And before I get going, I just have a quick question. How many of you still have a landline here in St. Paul? Less than half? Throughout the state. And that's pretty indicative of what's going on in our industry. And as Mr. Eloff mentioned earlier, there are several regulatory milestones that have led us to this point. And probably the first one was the breakup of the original AT&T in 1984. And then in 1996, the Federal Telecommunications Act focused on creating telecom competition. And most recently, the FCC's transformation order in November of 2011, the goal of which was to transform the traditional telephone network to an internet protocol or IP network. And unfortunately, Minnesota regulation has not kept up with these changes. The last major changes to telecom regulation was in 1995. Now think for a minute what telephone service was like in 1995. You couldn't carry your cell phone in your pocket unless you were in cargo pants. There was no broadband, and nobody I know would have used the word smart and phone in the same sentence. And the FCC's transformation order basically dictates local service rates and state access rates, which are what telephone companies charge each other to terminate calls from one point to another in the state. These are charges that used to be controlled by the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce. Now, like many of you, I carry a smartphone with me everywhere I go. And I've got three telephone numbers that come to this device. Through the advances in modern technology, my home phone in Medelia rings to here. And then I have cell service, and then I also have a Google Voice number. Now, all three of those services provide the same service, for allow me to talk to somebody else, but they do so in three very different ways and are regulated completely different. My landline service at home is regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, by the Department of Commerce, and by the FCC. My cell service is regulated by the FCC, and my Google Voice service isn't regulated at all. That's what we're talking about. This bill, House File 985, is a continuation of a process that started last year. And since the last session, we've had meetings with all kinds of stakeholders. And our goal is to create a state regulatory environment that is not only current for the industry as it exists today, but will also serve customers for years to come. Ultimately, this legislation benefits consumers by providing flexibility for providers to meet consumer needs. Ensuring customer protection laws currently in statute remain intact, such as slamming and cramming, as previously outlined. It maintains basic service regulation for those folks who just want plain old telephone service. It maintains oversight between wholesale relationships, between incumbent carriers and competitors. And this bill asks VoIP providers to register with the state for the purposes of collecting 911, TAP, TAM, and other programs. There is no intent to assert state regulation, merely an effort to obtain information and a method for these VoIP service providers to participate in those programs. We're looking for something that works. In closing, Mr. Chairman, this is a work in progress. We will continue to work with interested stakeholders, from state regulators to other industry segments and consumer groups. Minnesota is slipping behind the curve. Several other states have already enacted legislation to keep up with the changes in technology and federal regulation, including a number of our neighboring states. Appreciate your consideration, and I will stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Christensen. One question I have for you. Who would you say, just so members are aware, are the major stakeholders that we're talking about when you say we're meeting with stakeholders? Who are they?
The wireless carriers, companies that provide VoIP services, competitive local exchange carriers, the cable industry. Obviously the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission and anybody that's got an interest in this.
Very good. Thank you so much. Questions for our testifier? Representative Simonson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you mentioned that Minnesota was falling behind the curve, or I think maybe was in danger of falling behind the curve. Anyway, my question is, can you give me a sense of how many states have made this sort of a change and have kind of gotten ahead of us, so to speak? And then this part B of that would be you talked about some neighboring states. So I'm just curious where we're at in terms of our region.
There's probably 10 states that I'm aware of that have enacted legislation or are in the process of doing that. Wisconsin did enacted legislation last year or the year before, I can't remember which did many of these things, and a lot of this stuff was patterned after. Iowa's taken action. Kansas has enacted legislation. Indiana, Illinois is working on it now. So there's it. And this is all happening, like I said, being triggered by the transformation order from the FCC, which came out. And that, you know, if you look at what the state used to do, and when they used to regulate, they looked at our tariffs. And to Representative Kiefer's point earlier, I think they've got a little confusion about what the tariff is. And a tariff is when a telephone company files the rates with the commission, which is reviewed by the Department of Commerce, and then enacted, and that's the service rates that we can charge. Those aren't taxes or fees. That's a whole separate issue. So when you look at those issues and setting local service rates, setting the access rates that telephone companies charge each other, and those are now being dictated by the FCC. Mm-hmm. So you pull those out of the mix, that changes the landscape. And we feel that this legislation is going along that track.
Thank you.
Very good. Representative Fisher?
Thank you, Chair. As I'm looking at this, one of the areas I get a little confused on is I see the mention about Internet protocol-enabled services, et cetera, which to me refers to the Internet broadband capability. Does this also start regulating in the broadband area, too, or is that left and Internet in those areas, or does that leave those areas totally out of this purview?
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Christensen?
Sure. No, that broadband is not regulated. It's regulated by the FCC. The state has no jurisdiction over broadband. And I'm making the distinction between broadband, as in the pipe, the delivery pipe, and the Internet protocol, which is the technology that goes over that. And if you think about, you know, this is all built as a telephone network over 100 years ago. The Internet's built on top of the telephone network. And now we're trying to make the shift from a telephone network to a broadband world. And IP is the technology that's sending the signals across the lines, as opposed to TDM, which is time division multiplexing, which was the old telephone service. Did that answer your question, I hope?
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Testifier. It helps in some ways. It kind of it opens up, because it sounds like some of the ways that things are being communicated right now are over areas that we have no purview over, which should by the FCC, and other parts are not. And so it sounds like it can be confusing at times. Is trying to get from, I'm just thinking, if you're trying to get from point A to point B with a signal, and I'm thinking people out, say, in a rural area trying to get in, around here in the cities, I don't see the issues as greatly as when you're in the outlying areas. And how do we, you know, address to make sure that we still have that protection out in the outlying areas? And I guess where some of it comes in is when I start thinking of, you know, some of the information we heard earlier this year about Internet availability and how we get from one area to the other. Sometimes that last mile or so gets to be most challenging. I'm trying to figure out what part this covers and what part it doesn't cover.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Fisher, that's a very good question. And I guess the best way for me to answer that is, you know, you've got a broadband pipe that goes to your home, and over that you get voice service or traditional telephone service. You get video service. You get your TV a lot of times over that pipe. It's particularly in the rural areas where my members serve. And then you also get just access to the Internet. And like my example with the phones, those three services, even though they go down the same pipe, the broadband pipe, they're regulated completely different. Video service, cable TV is regulated, you know, by local franchise. Broadband is regulated by the FCC, and then the telephone service is regulated by the state and by the FCC. And it's that telephone service piece that we're addressing here.
Okay. Thank you. That clarifies things
for
me. Thank you very much.
Further questions from members? Thank you very much, Mr. Christensen,
Thank
for
you.
Your testimony. Peter Brickwady from the Department of Commerce, I think, is here. Welcome. If you identify yourself for the record, and go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Peter Brickwady, Director of Government Affairs for the Minnesota Department of Commerce, and I have a letter from Commissioner Rothman for committee members, if the page wanted to hand that out. And Mr. Chairman, I won't read the letter verbatim, but do want to highlight just a couple of things. And first of all, I'd like to very much express the department's appreciation to you for scheduling the informational hearing today. This is an important issue and one that the department has been working on, obviously, in its regulatory capacity for some time, but in particular over the last couple of years since the FCC order that's been previously referenced. And so this is an important area for Minnesota consumers and businesses, and so we appreciate the opportunity to be able to speak on it and continue to work with you. And we've been having a constructive discussion thus far, and I do want to say that Mr. Christensen and the MTA have been very forthcoming with their efforts with the department. We've had a lot of constructive conversation, and I look forward to that continuing. And I want to say thank you to their organization because we have had a number of discussions on this. And even though I think we have some differences about the legislation that's before you today, I think we're looking forward to continuing to work with them and other interested parties and stakeholders as we go forward. As Commissioner Rothman's letter indicates, we do have several concerns with the bill as it is drafted. I think if I had an overarching point to make, I think the department's perspective on what's happening in the telecom area is that the state does need to modernize its telecommunications regulation, modernize to the department is not synonymous with deregulate. We think that the starting point for any rewrite of the chapter should be robust consumer protections, not necessarily an elimination of the state's regulatory role. I'd like to draw your attention to the last two paragraphs of Commissioner Rothman's letter in particular. The second to last paragraph has been some discussion about what's going on with the FCC orders, and while I certainly do appreciate that other states have taken some steps towards adjusting their state laws, the FCC or the federal landscape is by no means completely settled yet. The FCC's order is being challenged and litigated in several regards. And so the situation is still somewhat fluid. We expect, as the letter indicates, that oral arguments are scheduled to begin this November. And so we appreciate the opportunity that Mr. Chair, you're putting forward, that we'll have an opportunity to continue to work over the interim, because I think if we can continue to monitor what's going on at the federal level with the court cases that are moving forward and continue to plan for that while not necessarily taking action prior to the full resolution of those cases, we've seen the department believes that's appropriate. And lastly, I again would draw your attention, members, to the last paragraph of Commissioner Rothman's letter. We do really appreciate the time that the committee is taking to put into this, and we do look forward to obtaining input from all of the interested parties and working together in a collaborative process to put together a rewrite of the chapter that eventually does modernize the telecommunications regulatory scheme here in the state of Minnesota, but does so in a way that provides strong recourse for consumers and businesses and protections for them, but also recognizes the changing landscape in which we live. So with that, members, I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Very good. Sounds like it's a work in progress from your perspective. Representative Uglum?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickery, you mentioned, and in the letter it mentions, that the bill removes all residential and business telecommunication services from regulatory safeguards that protect the customers. Could you expand on that? I mean, specifically, what are your concerns?
Mr. Brickwood, Mr. Chairman, and I may ask our Assistant Commissioner Dennis Ehlers to join me up at the table, who can go into greater detail than I can. Representative, I think at a high level, I think the issues that are highlighted in the two paragraphs immediately following the one that you just cited are, I think, two of our primary concerns. One is
basic services.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes, the narrowing of the definition of what basic services constitutes, I think, is one of our primary concerns. We've had several constructive conversations with the MTA about this issue in particular. I think it, as one of the previous testifiers mentioned, it does, the bill does keep the regulation of basic services, quote-unquote, in place, but by narrowing the definition of what constitutes basic services, we think the practical effect would be essentially eliminating the regulatory oversight for businesses and residential consumers there. Secondly, I think the not having a regulatory body at the state level to turn to, I think, is a concern for the Commerce Department. And that is one of the things that we've had, I think, some strong conversations with the MTA about is what, how do you define that role? Is the state going to be staying in this traditional mold of sort of utility rate cases, if you will, at the PUC, or is there another way to still provide adequate consumer protections to businesses and residential customers, to provide a venue for complaints to be resolved? That's one of the things I think we look forward to working on going forward.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Uglum.
Yes, so the venue for complaints to be resolved is one of your big issues.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think also the method by which complaints are resolved, too. I think that's something that we'd like to look at as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Any further questions? Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Brickwitty. You were just speaking about the state level regulatory. Maybe it would help all of us here, or maybe just those of us at the table, to talk about who's regulated and how people are regulated and who isn't regulated and how people are getting telecom services right now.
Mr. Brickwitty.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe, we'd be happy to do that, and perhaps the most comprehensive way to do that would be if we put together some information on that for the members of the committee. We could have that distributed after the hearing. But broadly, I think I would agree with the testimony that's been offered by the previous witnesses in terms of the regulatory schematic, if you will. The state has regulatory authority over the traditional wired phone service in the state and has for some time and shares that jurisdiction with the FCC. Wireless service is regulated at the federal level, and folks who are receiving, in both residential and commercial customers who are receiving their phone service from a non-traditional phone company, if you will. So, for example, anyone who has their phone service through their cable company, that's regulated both at the local and at the federal level. And so I would agree wholeheartedly with Mr. Christensen's testimony earlier that particularly when we get into the conversation about broadband, I would draw a distinction along the lines that Mr. Christensen did, separating telecom service and regulation from broadband service and regulation. Those are two separate things, and I would agree again with him that the FCC order is certainly pointing us in the direction of moving towards a broadband regulatory scheme as opposed to a telephone regulatory scheme. How we do that, though, and still maintain consumer protections for individuals and businesses who do still receive their service through traditional phone service, particularly, and I would agree with, I apologize, I don't remember which member mentioned it earlier, but I think this is particularly an issue in greater Minnesota, where broadband service is not yet as robust as we would like it to be, that this is an important issue going forward.
Representative Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Brickwitty, you just mentioned, I'm paraphrasing, but things getting settled. I think you mentioned that earlier. It might be in the commissioner's letter. I mean, I'm not going to hold you to this because I don't think any of us can know, but what do you think, when do you think things will be settled? Will things be settled? Or are we going to continue? I mean, technology is changing so rapidly. Are we years behind from a regulatory perspective?
Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hoppe, I appreciate you not your willingness to not hold me to my answer. I do. It is a struggle for any regulatory body or legislature to keep up with the pace at which technology evolves. And so I think that is one of the primary drivers of wanting to examine the entire chapter of law here in Minnesota, because I think if we can create a flexible regulatory scheme that is not necessarily technology specific, that allows businesses to operate and provides robust consumer protections for individual customers, both at the residential and commercial classes, that will be helpful and would be prudent for the state to do so. In terms of when do we expect the landscape to be settled somewhat, the sands have been shifting certainly since the order was first brought down from the FCC in 2010. Chairman of the Commerce Commission, or Committee, excuse me, were involved in some of those initial discussions right after the order was done. We do expect that there is going to be some movement beginning later this year as the cases, the challenges to the FCC order finally move their way through litigation. We would hope that they would be completed expeditiously. I don't have a final date for how long that is going to take, but hopefully that will provide some final clarity to us on many of the key issues going forward.
Thank you.
Very good. Any other further questions? Representative Euclid?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Prickritty, in the Commissioner's letter, there's also a reference to some concern about pricing. In the last paragraph on the first page, exorbitant pricing rates by their sole provider. Is that strictly because there will be no oversight or regulation, and how do you foresee that working out?
Mr. Brickley?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, generally I think that is our broad concern, and I'd note immediately that I don't believe the Commissioner intended for this to be a accusatory type of letter or by any means for any of our providers currently in Minnesota. I think what we are trying to highlight is the potential for a situation where costs could go up and consumers would not necessarily have recourse to a regulatory entity in the state file complaints or potentially attempt to spur regulatory action to examine those potential cost increases or reductions in service for them. So I think what we're trying to highlight is, again, that potential for those costs, and that's something that we look forward to working on with the various stakeholders and trying to craft language that would alleviate that concern.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions for testifiers?
I have a quick question.
Representative Keeper?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. So following up on that, wouldn't the PUC take the complaints? And then on price fixing, there was one thing in the House research, in your letter that says you're concerned about not having oversight on mergers, but I see that I can't find that in the House research section. So a couple of questions there. But
Mr. Rickley,
Mr. Chair, Mr. Chair, Representative Keeper, kind of two questions mm-hmm. there. On pricing, again, sort of a similar type of situation with Representative with the previous question. I think again, our concern is under the current process, rates are filed with the Public Utilities Commission. They are reviewed by the Department of Commerce, and much like in the energy area, the Department of Commerce is charged with representing the public interest in utility matters, utility rate matters. And so the removal or elimination of the department's role under this bill would eliminate that review and in some cases also eliminate the PUC's ability to exercise that review. Now, in some cases, I think the previous testifiers have highlighted that the FCC is setting some of those rates going forward, and that is true, but I think working out the details is always going to be the tricky part. And again, how does the state provide recourse to consumers for activities that are in this traditional area of regulation is the key point going forward. To your second question about mergers, and I apologize, I don't have the house. I didn't bring my house research summary up. I hope Mr. Eliff doesn't.
Mr. Eliff might want to comment here just briefly.
Mr. Chair, response to Representative Kiefer's questions. I think those issues are dealt with in the House Research Bill Summary on page 4, which describes the sections that are being repealed. About the middle of the page, section 237.23 right now prohibits the acquisition of another telephone company's property without commission approval. That is being repealed. And the following section, 237.231, prohibits the sale of a local exchange without commission approval, and that is also being repealed.
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Brickwitty.
At a broad level, Representative Kiefer, I think we can all agree that certainly major mergers or acquisitions of regulated utilities in the state of Minnesota, the last major one that we had in this area was the merger between CenturyLink and Quest. Those are certainly of interest to Minnesota consumers and certainly something that the state would want to be able to take a look at from a regulatory perspective to make sure that Minnesota consumers would be protected in those events, as I think we did along with the PUC quite productively, along with the businesses themselves during the CenturyLink Quest merger.
Very good. Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have really one question, and I'll preface it by saying that I realize we have a long ways to go, and this is the first of many discussions, right? So, but I'm looking at the letter from that you provided us, and thank you for that. But on the last paragraph of the first page, it says, under this proposed legislation, a small business with two lines would not be able to turn to the PUC or Department of Commerce to investigate problems it was having with such services and obtain a solution. And I'm just curious, Mr. Chair, maybe we can get an answer as to how such a complaint would be handled under the provisions of this bill.
Mr. Brickwood, do you have a response to that inquiry?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simonson, I may defer to Mr. Eliff on that particular question because the department was not involved in drafting the bill, so I think our perspective on that is without, generally speaking, I can answer what our concern is.
Okay.
Without the Department of Commerce, certainly from an investigatory perspective, and broadly the PUC as the final arbiter of disputes, having jurisdiction over this area, I think a small business in Minnesota would not have a state-based recourse to turn to if they were having problems with their service. I can give you just a practical example. Fairly recently, the department received some inquiries from a fairly major employer in northwest Minnesota that was having difficulty with call completion concerns, and so the Department of Commerce was able to ascertain what was going on in that situation and able to help sort out that problem and provide for a short-term fix while trying to address the long-term solution going forward. That's the type of role that a state regulator can play, and I think we're looking forward to continuous discussions with the MTA and other stakeholders about exactly how to define that type of consumer protection role for the state going forward in this new world in which we live, thanks to the FCC order.
This is an informational hearing. I see Mr. Christensen thinks he has a response that might be informative for Representative Simonson. So go ahead and comment.
Thank you, Mr.
Again,
Chairman.
Again, identify yourself for the tape.
Again, Brent Christensen with the MTA. Mr. Chairman, Representative Simonson, the regulatory world we live in now, the Public Utilities Commission is almost a quasi-judicial authority. So if someone has a complaint in this current structure with only landline telephone service, not cellular, not anything else, they can file a complaint at the PUC. The Department of Commerce has always had a traditional role of acting as the advocate for the consumer and investigates those along with the staff at the PUC. So you have two bodies investigating the complaint, and then action is taken by the commission. What this bill is proposing to do is eliminate some of that now and then phase that out by 2019, and I'll tell you why that date in just a second. The reason for that is we're not monopolies anymore. We're not like gas companies and electric companies where that environment still makes sense. We're regulated a lot by the fourth regulator in our environment, and that's the consumer. They have choices now. They can go other places for telephone service and do. People can cut the cord and go strictly with cell phones. They can, and that's not just residences, that's small businesses. Businesses now with four business lines or more are already deregulated.
So we're talking about people, customers, businesses with four lines or less, and then people that just have, that have more than just telephone service at home, of deregulating that to level that playing field. So that's the change in this environment. Now, the reason for the July 1st, 2019 date is because two of the major things that the Public Utilities Commission and the Department of Commerce regulate are local service rates, your monthly phone bill, and also access charges, what long-distance companies pay local companies to terminate calls in their area. And the reason for that date is by that time, the FCC has ratcheted down access rates to 0.0007 of a percent, of a penny, per minute of use. So that basically takes that off the table. I don't even know how to bill for that. So that takes that off the table. Residential rates have a floor. They're going to be up to $30 by way before that time. So that takes two huge pieces of what has been done in this traditional regulatory scheme off the table now. So what's left are consumer protection actions and activities, TAP, TAM, those programs, Lifeline. Those programs we're proposing to move over to the PUC because we're just consolidating. We've got the same number of regulators regulating a service that's dwindling away. That's the bottom line here.
Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. So, and I'm just trying to understand here. In the example given in the letter from the DOC, and it, let's shift to the language in the bill now. If this individual business with two lines, as the example is, they really don't have anybody to turn to with a complaint outside of their provider.
Mr. Christensen.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simonson, they do. They can go somewhere else. If there's not a competitive landline area in provider in that environment, there are multiple cell carriers in that environment. And so they're going to. To the call completion issue that Mr. Brickwitty just spoke about, state has no jurisdiction over that if the call originates outside the state. So they only have jurisdiction over calls that begin and end in the, within the state boundaries. So in that particular, and I'm familiar with what he's talking about there, and we could have a whole other hearing on call completion because that's a huge problem for our industry. In that area, you know, they can come in and they can talk to the different parties and they can try and get something resolved, but at the end it's the provider that's gonna do it anyway and going to get, you know, with the FCC and hopefully get the issue resolved or do a workaround like it's been done in several cases.
Thank you.
Very good. And back to the Commerce Department there. Could give you a chance to anything you want to add. Thank you, Mr. Christensen, for your comments. Anything else you want to add, Mr. Brickwitty?
Mr. Chairman, not at this time. As I said, be happy to respond to questions, certainly as we go forward throughout the legislative session and then into the interim. Really want to thank you for continuing this process. Representative Hoppe, who has led a lot of discussion over the last 2 years as well. As I've said, we are looking forward to this discussion. We think it is going to be a very important one for Minnesota consumers and businesses. We want to make sure we get it right, so looking forward to working with you.
Good. Thank you for your testimony. And Mr. Lipschultz, welcome. Thanks for coming down and testifying. If you'd identify yourself for the record, and then go ahead. And
Dan Lipschultz with the law firm of Moss & Barnett.
Mr. Lipschultz, I know you know this stuff well. If you could, before what it is you're going to say, if you could just clarify for the members the difference between an ILEC and a CLEC, that would be, I think, helpful.
An ILEC is, this is an industry of acronyms, and so I'll start with ILEC. ILEC is, stands for Incumbent Local Exchange Carrier, and those are the telephone companies, the traditional telephone companies that have been around for 50, 100 years. The most obvious example in the metro area was U.S. West, which was previously Northwestern Bell, and later became Quest and now CenturyLink as a result of a number of mergers and acquisitions. A CLEC, a competitive local exchange carrier, and those are the folks I'm here to speak on behalf of, are the folks who didn't exist before 1996, and they exist today as a result of the telecommunications reforms in the late 90s, both by this legislature and Congress, passing the Telecom Act of 1996. As I said, I represent a group here of competitive local exchange carriers, or CLECs. That's our acronym. Those who don't like us call us CLECs. And I remember years ago, Southwestern Bell's chairman, Mr. Whitaker, referred to me as a CLEC representative in a really venomous tone, but I'm over it. I represent some of the folks I represent you've heard of, others you probably haven't: Integra Telecom, TW Telecom, Velocity Telecom, Orbitcom, and Popcom. Lots of comms in CLEC names. I don't know why, that's just the way it's ended up. And I'm glad, and I want to say, first of all, clarify for the record, in spite of what you may have heard, my clients, CLECs, are regulated by the Public Utilities Commission. Our retail services are regulated, and I know that because I used to be Public Utilities Commission counsel, and I was involved in drafting the rules that specifically regulated CLEC retail services, and I've been representing CLECs for years in front of the Commission on a number of matters that involve regulation of my client services. Having said that, I'm glad that I followed the Department of Commerce, because I heard the term consumer protection mentioned a number of times. So let me state emphatically what my clients believe, and personally what I believe in my 20 years doing this, that the best protection for consumers is competition. And I think the evidence bears that out. And let me give you two specific examples. There are many, many more. Let's talk about the availability of services and technological innovation. The first broadband service introduced in the country was DSL. We've all heard of DSL. DSL was actually invented by the Bell monopoly, and it sat in the Bell lab for years. It was never deployed. It was never offered to consumers. The first company to offer DSL broadband was a CLEC that took that technology and found a way to introduce it to consumers in a way that made sense for consumers at a price that consumers could afford. Another example, pricing. The basic service that most businesses get from a telecom carrier is what's called a T1 service. The price of a T1, just one T1 line, was $1,600 a month, $1,600 a month back in 2000. It's now $200 a month. That's an 88% reduction. That didn't come from any regulatory order. That came from the competition, primarily that my clients and others like my clients provide. That's the background I think you need to understand as you move forward. Now, what you hear is a lot of stuff, and it's true, there's a lot of technological change. Fiber versus copper, VoIP service versus traditional time division multiplexing, wireless phones now on top of wireline phones, data, broadband. You hear all these terms, and you hear about all this technological change, but I want you to take a step back for a minute and see the world as it exists from the consumer's perspective, and my clients are dealing with these consumers on a daily basis. Think about your own office. Don't think about your home. 30% of residential customers have cut the cord. Think about your office here. You look at your office, and amidst all the stacks of papers and all the bills and everything you have a phone and you have a laptop or a computer, and both are hardwired into the hardwired landline network. You think about all of the state offices, every individual office, legislative offices, state government offices, hospitals, medical clinics, law offices, the tens of thousands of small businesses, medium-sized businesses, and the many larger businesses around this state. Every single office and every single business has a hardwired landline phone and a computer next to it, both drawing their service through the same pipe. And that's important to remember. Your phone service and your broadband service, for the most part, with some exceptions, as a business, are coming from the incumbent local exchange carrier pipe or perhaps the cable company's pipe. So everybody, certainly in the business commercial world, relies on landline service, both for phone and data. And secondly, and this is really important, those services are delivered over either one or maybe two pipes, and that's it. It's the pipes that matter. It's the pipes that choke off or potentially choke off competition. So if you want to continue to have the benefits of competition, which are well documented, if you really want to protect consumers, you ought to target your regulation, and to the extent you change the statute, make sure the statute targets regulation at ensuring an open, competitive market where competitors can compete robustly. Not just one or two, not just a duopoly, but three, four, five, six different competitors using what are invariably going to be one or two pipes, because it's never going to be economic for 4, 5, 6, 7 carriers to replicate the entire telecommunications network, building lines, fiber or copper, to every single home and business in the state. That's not going to happen. That's why 15 years ago, Congress and this legislature said, to have competition, we are going to require the incumbent local exchange carrier to provide access to its network at a fee, to lease that last mile network to competitors so that they can actually get access to the homes and businesses around the state, to require the incumbent local exchange carrier to interconnect with other carriers' networks as they build their own networks, and empowering the Public Utilities Commission in this state to police that marketplace, because a large incumbent carrier will invariably push the boundaries to keep competitors from coming into their markets. It's not improper. It would be insane if they didn't do that. Every company, including my companies, the ones I represent, want to be a monopoly. Nobody wants competitors competing with them. Business isn't a sport. You want to make money. So if you want to protect the public interest, you've got to recognize those impulses that we all have, including my clients, to monopolize an industry and make sure that they don't, so that we do have competition. And then I think you really don't need the level of regulation on the retail side we have today. I think you can further reduce retail regulations. We've already reduced them dramatically over the last 20 years. You can reduce them further, but you have to make sure you have that competitive foundation in place going forward with a fully empowered Public Utilities Commission to enforce those conditions that open these markets to competition. And with that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Good. Thank you for that overview, Mr. Lipschitz. Any questions from members right now? Or do you want to mull it over? Thank you very much for your testimonies. Is there any further testimony for anyone in the audience who want to step forward and add anything?
See you later.
Seeing none, any questions from members right now? Now, what we're going to do is the chair, I'm going to move that this matter, House File 985, be laid over for consideration in the 2014 legislative session. In the interim, further work will be done by the stakeholders that were cited. And again, members, if you do have any questions, feel free to ask, and we'll see if we can get you the information. And that'll do it for today. Meeting's adjourned. Thank you.